From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Korean Context, news and analysis from the Korean Peninsula.
Hello, and welcome to Korean Context. My name is Kyle Ferrier. I'm the Director of Academic Affairs and Research at KEI, and I will be your guest host for today. International financial governance, the topic of this podcast, is often overlooked until it is staring at us in the face. Yet if we have learned one thing from the global financial crisis nearly a decade ago, it's that cooperation to prevent and prepare for financial crises is crucially important. To this end, global institutions such as the G20 and IMF have received significant attention, but complementary institutions at the regional level also play an important role. Today's guest is here to discuss Korea's role in East Asia's regional financial governance and why this role is important. So, Ramon, can you explain what international financial governance is and how it's a multi-layered system?
So it's basically a system to manage financial markets in three different ways. First of all, through crisis prevention. Secondly, through crisis management. But thirdly, also through market strengthening, to make the markets stronger so there's no need to activate the other mechanisms. Now, we say it is multi-layer because there are three or four different levels at which it operates. You have the global layer, you have the IMF, Financial Stability Board, Basel Committee for Banking Supervision, but you also have a regional layer in different parts of the world, so the European Union, for example, Middle East as well. But East Asia has its own regional layer, and you have institutions such as the China City Multilateralization, ASEAN Plus 3 Macroeconomic Research Office, et cetera, et cetera. And then you have what some people call one layer, some people call two layers, which we're talking about bilateral swap arrangements and self-defense mechanisms, for example, in the form of reserves that can be used for a bailout package. So for some people, this is part of the same layer. For some people, we're talking about two different layers.
Great. So when we talk about the financial governance and the importance of it, we're really talking about how to deal with financial crises, as you brought up, in terms of financial crisis management and prevention. And the crises themselves often serve as a catalyst to strengthen and expand existing institutions and even create new ones. Can you talk about what regional financial governance looked like in East Asia prior to the global financial crisis and what changes took place after the global financial crisis?
If you look at East Asia, and we leave ASEAN aside, you could argue that financial governance only started after the East Asian financial crisis, when countries in the region realized that they had to cooperate with each other to prevent or solve any future crisis. So first of all, we have a market strengthening. So you see how in 2003, we have the launch of the Asian Bond Markets Initiative, which basically means that East Asian countries and East Asian corporations can launch locally denominated bonds. They don't have to issue bonds in dollars. They can do this, but they can also issue locally denominated bonds. And this will actually be bought by, for example, central banks across East Asia. You also have crisis prevention in the form of the Economic Review and Development Policy, in which what you basically see is ministers of finance in East Asia that are trying to monitor the situation by having regular meetings. Now, this wasn't as effective as mechanisms developed later on. But finally, you also have crisis resolution in the form of the Chama Initiative launched in the year 2000, which was basically a set of bilateral swap arrangements between the different countries in the region, up to $84 billion in total. And if countries wanted to activate it, they would have to go country by country to activate these mechanisms.
So up to now, we've sort of talked in broad strokes about what international financial governance is and how it's been implemented in Asia. And let's talk a little bit more about Korea's role in all of this. In your paper, you talk about Korea's centrality in advancing regional financial institutions after the global financial crisis, some of which you had just mentioned. In what ways was Korea central to these developments?
What you see is that after 2008, all these mechanisms, they're upgraded, and some of them are created anew. So we see how the Chama Initiative multilateralization becomes a reality, has been discussed since 2005, which basically means that you don't have bilateral swap arrangements anymore. You have a single arrangement for the whole of East Asia, in which the different countries in the region, they pledge an amount And this can be used by the countries in the region in case there is a crisis. They can borrow from this mechanism. They don't have to go country by country. There's also a precautionary line in case they want to activate it before a crisis actually hits a particular country. Now, when this was being created, you see Korea playing a central role in two ways. First of all, there were discussions about how much each country was to contribute to it, and especially how much were Japan and China going to contribute. And Korea helped to have the different countries in the region reach an agreement about the level of contribution. But there was also a discussion about the voting power, how much voting share was each country going to have, not only the lenders, which are basically China, Japan, and Korea, but also the borrowers or potential borrowers from the Chairman Initiative, countries in Southeast Asia, the Asian countries. And again, Korea played a very important role here. Then you see the creation of a second institution. This second institution is the ASEAN Pacific Macroeconomic Research Office, which is a surveillance unit that is there to monitor economic conditions in the region to be able to prevent a crisis. Or if the Chairman Initiative Authorization is activated, it would be monitoring the implementation of the agreement. Now, Korea pushed for this institution to be created and for this institution to become a legally international organization. So it is not made up of the different countries reaching a decision together on how to operate. You have an organization that legally has been established, so it can decide how to operate by itself, which is something new in ASEAN Plus 3, didn't exist before. And Korea, again, was instrumental in pushing for this to happen because there were discussions going on since the inception of the institution. It only happened in 2016. Other than that, you see how Korea has played a balancing role between China and Japan when they have problems, when they cannot agree. It had tried to bring them to the table, sit down together. Plus, it had played this role as a bridge between the developed countries in the region, so Japan, for example, Hong Kong as well, and the developing countries, especially in Southeast Asia.
Why would they look to Korea? Well, those developing countries in Southeast Asia. What about the Korean story really speaks to them in supporting Korea in these roles?
I think there are two main reasons. First of all, Korea used to be a developing country that now has graduated and suffered during this development a financial crisis in 1997 when it was probably an emerging country back then. So countries in East Asia, Southeast Asia, they can relate to this experience. The Japanese experience is very far away in time, right? If you look at China, it's a completely different beast. It's the biggest economy in the world by some measures, otherwise the second biggest economy. So they cannot relate to these cases. With Korea, they actually can. It's a big economy, one of the 15 biggest in the world, 13 right now. But it is not, so it is a big economy, but not as big as the other ones. Plus, if you look at the population, 50 million people is not too far off from the population that some countries in Southeast Asia have that are more or less a little bit above or a little bit below that level. And they cannot relate to, again, China, 1.3 million people, even Japan, 120 million people, more or less. So I think that's the first reason. The second reason is that nobody thinks that Korea wants to dominate the region in the same way as China and Japan might. And this is an important point for many Southeast Asian countries. They see Korea as a honest broker, a country that is willing to reach an agreement, not for its own sake, or to try to dominate the region, or to try to get something in return, return of providing its capital to these initiatives, but a country that actually wants to strengthen the region for its own self-interest, to prevent a crisis in Korea itself, but also for the good of the region as a whole.
And I want to backtrack just a little bit. We're talking about Korea's centrality and what's really driving it in regional institutions. Can you sort of talk a little bit more about the factors and to explain why Korea has played such an important role as a mediator and as a central power in advancing regional financial institutions?
Well, I think one of the most important reasons is that from the beginning, from the onset of these institutions, Korea was supporting them. No matter what type of regime you had in Korea, whether a liberal regime or a conservative regime, these governments would support institutionalization of ASEAN Plus 3. And this is not always the case with other countries. With China and Japan, this has come and go. But even with some Southeast Asian countries, if you look at Indonesia, for example, now it's trying to have, you know, its own independent role. So not all other countries in the region have been willing to do this. I think this is a very important factor. Now, secondly, you see how capital markets, the financial sector, has become more important for South Korea. Since this is the case, Korea actually has an interest in ASEAN plus three institutions being stronger, both in case there might be a crisis in Korea, but also in case of contagion. Let's say there is a crisis in Thailand, such as in 1997, and this actually spreads to the rest of the region. Well, Korea actually wants to prevent that, and now that financial markets are started to become more integrated in the region, with financial flows and trade flows across the region increasing in importance. So I think that's a second important reason, right, the development of the financial sector in Korea. And I think also that if you look at the ASEAN centrality, it has been declining before, but especially after the global financial crisis. You see divisions among Southeast Asian countries, Indonesia, Singapore, trying to have their own independent role. Countries such as Malaysia, for example, they don't want Indonesia to lead the region as well. You see them, for example, trying to sign their own bilateral FTAs, not ASEAN as a region, but their own bilateral FTAs. So Vietnam and Singapore have done this with the European Union, for example. Other countries have FTAs with the US, for example. So these divisions within ASEAN means that there is a void that Korea can fill. Korea can fill it because of its support for the region, as I mentioned before, its office interest, but also because it has the human resources and the financial resources to play this role.
Now, we're talking about regional institutions and what sort of happened in recent developments in terms of regional financial cooperation has been a proliferation of these bilateral swap agreements that sort of are not necessarily falling within the range of the set institutions in Asia from the People's Bank of China and the Chiang Mai Initiative Multilateralization, the core provider of liquidity in the region to the regional financial institutions, was supposed to increase the delinkage part from the IMF from 30 to 40%, which would, in certain circumstances would make Asian countries who were members of the Chiang Mai Initiative Multilateralization more inclined to draw money from the Chiang Mai Initiative Multilateralization. Now, how important are regional institutions right now in light of these other possibly competing facilities to draw emergency liquidity?
I think that's a very important issue to discuss. The fact that you see all these different initiatives, especially as you mentioned, as the bilateral level, means that there are discussions about whether the regional layer is actually going to play any role in the future. Now, I think the first point to raise is that the regional layer is meant to be complementary to the other layers. So no one in East Asia is talking about these initiatives replacing the IMF, for example. There is cooperation taking place, and there are meetings, for example, between AMRO and the IMF, which their experiences are shared. But they can also be complementary to the bilateral layer. So if a country decides to activate a swap arrangement, let's say with the People's Bank of China or the Bank of Japan, this doesn't mean that they wouldn't be able to activate also any ASEAN plus three mechanism, like the Chiang Mai Initiative Multilateralization. So this could be used in parallel. Some countries actually might even feel more comfortable this way. They might say, well, why don't I borrow certain amount from China, certain amount from Japan, but also activate this regional mechanism? This is a possibility. Plus, if you look at the lenders, one of the issues with the way Chiang Mai Initiative Multilateralization is set up now is that there would be conditionality from the IMF in up to 70% of the amount that you can borrow. I mean, there are discussions about this, but at least that's how it should work in theory. Now, this would mean that this conditionality would make it more likely that countries would be returning the capital that they have borrowed. And from a lender's perspective, this is very appealing. China, to put it in very simple terms, has been burnt in some of its lending to places, to countries, for example, in Latin America, or even sub-Saharan Africa, probably wouldn't want this to happen if it has to lend to a country in Southeast Asia, let's say Cambodia or Laos. So in a sense, this complementarity among the different layers means that ASEAN plus 3 continues to be important. Plus, we shouldn't forget that if you look at AMRO, it is doing a very important monitoring role. It is true that the IMF also has a monitoring role within the region, but it is also true that the IMF doesn't have the same presence in ASEAN countries or ASEAN plus three countries that AMRO is starting to acquire, because it is made up of nationals from these countries. There are very regular trips to countries across the region, something IMF might not be able to do. So you have the complementary knowledge between AMRO institutions that know East Asia very well, and the IMF that might know at a very macro level how things operate in East Asia and in other regions as well. So you have, again, this complementarity. And surveillance is one of the key issues in East Asia, because what we want to do is we want to prevent a crisis. We don't want to solve a crisis. There is one other aspect that we often forget, which is market strengthening. So you have the HMO Markets Initiative. You also have the Credit Guarantee Investment Facility, so for corporates as well to issue their own local currency denominated bonds, which is $700 million. This market strengthening actually means that the probability of a crisis is lower, and the possibility of placing locally denominated debt has actually increased.
You've gone over why regional institutions are so important and sort of why Korea plays a central role in advancing them. What about looking forward? You've certainly touched upon the importance of Korea's role in the past and present, but how do you see Korea either being domestically or externally constrained or empowered to continue to have a central role in regional financial institutions?
In my view, at the domestic level, probably constraints are very few. You don't really see any constraints in the sense that Korea wants to continue to be seen as a middle power, wants to strengthen East Asia cooperation. Even in 2008, after the global financial crisis, when it went to the Federal Reserve, in parallel, it was trying to strengthen East Asian cooperation. Now, at the international level, that's a very interesting question, because China and Japan continue to try to create their own institutional frameworks. Especially China, I would argue, with RMB internationalization, as well as bilateral swap arrangements, EIB, etc., etc. Plus, obviously, the IMF, even though there is complementarity between East Asia and the global layer, you never know what might happen in the future, especially if the dealing portion of AMRO continues to, or JAM initiative multilateralization continues to increase. I think in this case, there could be constraints if Korea feels that it has to make a choice between China and Japan, or between the global layer and the regional layer. This hasn't happened yet, and I don't think Korea wants to do that. But at some point, who knows, this might be the case. Let's say the IMF goes to East Asia and says, okay, now you have to choose to an extent, right? You continue to cooperate with the IMF and you become stronger within the IMF, maybe you get a greater voting share, or you support East Asia. You don't see this happening anytime soon, but potentially it could happen. Also, I think if we went back to a crisis like the one Korea had in 1997, obviously this would be a very important economic but also diplomatic hit to Korea. I think the fact that it was one of the very few developed countries that avoided a recession actually during the global financial crisis is important to consider, because this actually strengthens its standing within the East Asia region. But if we weren't going to suffer another crisis, it has to borrow again from the IMF, obviously this would be different. This would be an international constraint on its position.
Before we finish up, is there anything else that we didn't get a chance to cover or go over that you think our listeners should know?
I think that there are two issues. First of all, is that this is an area in which finance, in which Korea has had actual results. I mean, we talk about middle powers trying to influence different regional institutions and global institutions. Well, this is an area in which Korea has actually had influence. And I think this is what drives the greater interest from Korean presidents and policymakers in supporting this regional layer. Even at the global layer, we saw, for example, how Korea successfully brought to the agenda global imbalances and problems between developed and developing countries, how they're affected by crisis. And secondly, I mean, we talk about finance, but this is part of Korea's broader middle power agenda. So there are issues such as green growth, different development paradigms, for example, even peacekeeping, peace building, where Korea is trying to play a greater role. So it's part of Korea's foreign policy, so to speak. And I think it's important to understand that this is one of the areas, along with these others and many others, in which Korea is trying to play a more important role, which I think explains why it will try to carry on playing this role, because it allows Korea to be portrayed in a different way and to be seen not only as a country affected by the North Korean nuclear issue, but also a country that plays an important role in international affairs.
This has been a really interesting conversation. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks to you for your invitation. I'm delighted to be here.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us here on Korean Context. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, please make sure to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you're getting your podcasts. And we'll see you here again next week for another great episode.